Computer. So, good morning again. We are recording now. So, and I'm also going to stop sharing of the overall plan, and I'm going to head over here to the pad. So, let's have a look at what we're doing today. So, we're in the midst of dynamic programming, and today. Now we will have a look at chapter 6.1. It is weighted interval scheduling. That's the first thing I will have a look at. And then I will actually give the example of matrix multiplication. That's over here. That will be an example of dynamic programming over intervals, but it won't be the RNA secondary structure of the book of Dramatic Touch. So it's a different example. And then I will have a look at the TSP, the traveling salesperson problem, which is also not here in the book, but it's I think a useful scheme for dynamic programming. Let's say it like that. So that means it's not necessarily actually it is not the best way to solve the TSP nowadays, but it's a good way of seeing how I can dynamic apply dynamic programming to more difficult problems. But there's the question of Guillermo about the knapsack. Can we spend some time with a couple of questions related to list two? Yes, we can. Fire the question if you want. Does the exchange argument calculation, as you did in the video of example two, bring always the best order to be used to order as it was in WIPI? Not necessarily. I mean, for the list, the answer is yes. Okay, I said not necessarily, because for the list, I also already gave the hint. Both problems have an optimal order, and they can be the optimal order can be found by looking for an exchange argument. In general, if you hit a novel or different problem, you won't know that, and not always the kind of exchange argument we are looking at. So if you try to explain the change argument, it can fail. Maybe there is no simple optimal order, and then you get some confusing expressions. But don't get the expression. So maybe from we are here, right? From interval scheduling over here on the greedy algorithms, and from the two exercises, you get the impression when it's about ordering sequences, just like space, research space, are all the permutations. There's always an optimal order. And you just make an exchange argument, and you find if you have to change to forward and backward, and then that's that. And that's not the case. You can't always solve it like that. For example, take the traveling salesman problem again. That's a permutation of the cities. So if you keep switching cities, adjacent cities or subsequent cities in the tour until you can no more, that's not an optimal solution. Sometimes it works, and sometimes you get a clear criterion, and then you can sort, and then you solve the problem in log n. And other times it won't. So short answer is yes for the list, in general, no. I'm using the sorting metric. I got to the exchange argument calculation question two, but when I swap the middle terms, I got a better result. This is a mathematical issue. Using this one, okay. But when I swap the two middle terms, maybe you should send me this, because I have to see the middle terms. I don't know. Maybe it's a mathematical issue. I mean, if you do it, so it seems what you're doing is right. Okay, you take the exchange argument, you calculate the objective function value. Afterwards and before, you make the difference, and you look if it's positive or negative, or what happens then, and that should give you a criterion after some algebra and some reformulation, which should lead into a sorting solution. But yeah, I mean, there can be details or small errors or calculations or stuff like that. Okay, you can send me, if you have that, you can send me a preview if you want, and I can have a quick look. Saying this for everyone, you can send me a quick preview. However, my time is limited. I mean, grading the exercise list, I sit down a good time. I have to read it from top to bottom. I have to get into everything. So again, just a reminder, okay, don't send me code. Send me explanations. I need to understand it. So if you explain less, I have to work harder to understand that. So I want, don't send me real code. Never send me real code. Send me pseudo code as high level as possible without losing precision and explanations. That's important. But commenting on the preview. So if you have a specific question, send me what you have in any state. And point out, okay, it's down there in the third paragraph, 2.1. There's a question, I'm confused about this term and so on. And I can have a quick look and a quick comment on that, or maybe a tip, okay? So Knapsack, maybe Guilherme, do you want to bring up a specific question, the Knapsack? Is there something? Because I wanted to skip Knapsack, but it's very similar to subset sum. And okay, if any, so the video on Knapsack is out. Okay, it's very similar to subset sum. It's a little bit more difficult, very similar. And maybe similar general problems come up again when I look at weighted interval scheduling right now. And you can ask here. And if you, after looking at the video, still have some issues with Knapsack at some point, it's not clear, send me again. And I can clarify this specifically. So let me head over to the slides. So dynamic programming part two, as I said at the beginning, so we will have a look at weighted interval scheduling, matrix multiplication, the traveling salesperson. So let's start with weighted interval scheduling. It's a very simple problem, and we have been discussing it at the beginning. If you remember, there were what was that in the book of Kleinberg-Taldrush, in the first chapter, there is five representative problems, and one of that was interval scheduling, and then the other was weighted interval scheduling. And we have seen that interval scheduling can be solved by a greedy algorithm, right? It's just earliest due date or earliest finishing time. You sort all the intervals by earliest finishing time, and then you pick up one after the other. So as before, we have a set of intervals that's the same. So I put this down here just to remember. You have a time axis, start at point zero. You have a set of intervals, start one, finish one, start two, finish two, and obviously can overlap. Otherwise, the question is pointless. Start three, finish three, and there may be start four and finish four, and so on. Okay. Different now, we have also weights. So maybe I put it in another color. So the first interval is has a volume or a weight of 3, and the second has 1 and 4 and 1 and so on. So now it's not only an issue of finding a set of non-overlapping intervals, but it's finding a set of non-overlapping intervals such that the total volume of these intervals is maximized. Okay. So maybe two more simple examples. So previously, we may have had something like this. And the optimal solution now is to take these two intervals because this is the largest number. Now, if I put a weight of 4 here and 1 there, the optimal solution is now this guy over there, because it has a volume of 4 alone. Okay, that's the difference. That makes the problem harder. Okay, with the problem definition, makes sense? Maybe give me a quick yes over there in the participants list. It's okay. So that looks like good. Otherwise, you just chat is empty. Good. So let's look at how we do this. The first simple observation is if you test all the subsets of intervals, it takes an omega of 2 to the n time. I mean, if you have n intervals, you have 2 to the n subsets, possible subsets, the empty subsets, all subsets containing one element, all subsets containing 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 elements, up to n elements. If you take that all and sum it together, it gets you 2 to the n subsets, including the empty and the complete subset. And then you have to test if the subset is non-overlapping, and then you have to sum the weights and just store the optimal one. That could be at least omega. So you need 2 to the n subsets time, depends how you implement the non-overlapping check and how you sum the weights you take, probably can do this in linear times. So you get something like order of the 2 to the n times n for doing that. That's brute force, just writing it down and finding the best one. But that's not the best way to do it. So as we have seen in the video, you can just sort the intervals 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 in by some criterion. For example, the starting date. And then you just look at the first interval in this sequence and you decide, is it in or out? And that has consequences. I mean, if the first interval is in, you get its volume. And then you have to see the overlaps. So if the first interval overlaps with the second, then the second would be out. Right? But from the third on, it may go on. And this, from the third on, I call this the successor of the interval. So this would be the successor of one. The first interval that can be chosen when you choose one. So you just take the volume of that. And if you call the volume of a solution V, that would be the volume of this subproblem, which has the successor of one. So best volume from 3 to the end plus V1. And the other possibility, obviously, is to, so that would be in, to be out. So the first is not in. Then you can just take the best solution from 2 to the end. And these are the two possibilities only. And then you go and find the best one, these two. And what I've written down here is a dichotomy, a basic decision for the first interval. But then for the second or the third or fourth interval on, you just repeat the same decision. So the subproblems are VIs, where you find the optimal solution for intervals I plus 1 down to n. These are the subproblems. And here you basically have the recursive definition already on the paper. We generalize this now, well, this was written down for the first interval. We generalize this now for any interval. So as we said, let VI be the best volume for intervals I to n. What we want then is V1, right? The best volume for all intervals from 1 to n. And then the above decision we have is just taking the maximum or, I called the successor. Up there, I call this S only. Yeah, it's the same. So that would be the next feasible interval when choosing I. That's the successor of I, or S of I, you understand. So either you continue with the successor, but you take the current interval. No, that doesn't work well. So take another color and do it by hand. So you continue with the successor, but you take the current interval and its volume, or you don't get the volume. But then you can continue with the next interval. And that's it. And if you hit the base case, that means no intervals, you get nothing. Base case is zero. Okay? So the reasoning here is just a basic observation that the subproblems can be represented by suffixes. That's important because it gives you a single argument I here that ranges from 1 to n, or to n plus 1 if you want to have the base case. Because this is at the end, that's looking for I more than n. And that makes the space here small. So subproblems are suffixes of the list of intervals, and the basic decision when you look at the first interval is it's in or out. That's all. Does that make sense? Okay, makes sense. Okay, that's the important part. That's the important part. So for finding solutions via dynamic programming, you would think about a problem like that. What are the subproblems? What are the decisions I have to take? If I take that decision, how does the problem get simpler? And what is the resulting subproblem? And then write down the recurrence. And here at this point, that's the important point. Here are the ideas. This was the creative part. Okay. The creative part stops here. Everything else is like I could almost implement a program does the rest for me. So I could write a program that takes this recurrence and produces code. So the creative part stops here. Okay. Here is the idea. And here is I go a little bit slowly because that's the point when you're in practice you want to apply the dynamic programming. That's how you should try to approach it in terms of decisions and subproblems. What do I know? How do I represent subproblems? How many subproblems are there? Okay, it seems okay. So let me clear that. And no question. Yes, okay. So what's the time and space complexity of that? If I implement it. Anyone, maybe? How many space or how much space I do need for storing all the V values? Yeah, how's it that same space is linear? Yeah. Okay, you have to store V1 and V2 and V3. We're gonna store all the subproblems, we're gonna cache them. Cache it, right? Up to Vn. Okay. And Vn minus plus one if you want. It doesn't matter. So this here is order of n. So space is order of n. Okay. Yeah, it's not exponential. It's not 2 to the n, okay? Because you have to only store the v1s. That makes it, if it would be 2 to the n, only storing all the subproblems is exponential time already, okay? It could be 2 to the n if you make it in a an unfortunate way. If you decide the order of the intervals in a random manner, it could be 2 to the n. But here it is only linear space. So a space is order of n. And now the time complexity. Well, or maybe someone. That's good, I guess. Time complexity. Maybe. Well, you have to compute all these volumes, V1, V2, V3, Vn. And each one is this operation over here. Take the maximum of two other volumes. So that's order one. Time complexity is also order one. Okay. So it's not 2 to the n. Not if you store the subproblem. Okay. Mind if you test, yes, yeah, maybe. Okay. That's an important let me see that. I put this over here, okay. That may be an important point. Everybody is guessing 2 to the n, and maybe my question is wrong. So what I wanted, give me 2 minutes so we come back to that point. Okay. Just to give the response, if you do this by dynamic programming, space is linear, time is linear. That's what we, yeah. For brute force, it would be, yes, for brute force. Okay, I see, okay. Now we're on the same page, okay. Yes, for brute force, that would be it. Also, look at the recurrence again. So Vi is the maximum of Vsi plus Vi plus Vi plus one. Okay, let me give you a little code that implements that recurrence directly. So first of all, let's look at this. We have a recursive implementation. We have a recursive implementation. The recursive implementation would just do it like this. So we have a function v, which takes an argument I, and what it does is this. So if I is more than n, we just return 0. That's our base case. And otherwise, you return the maximum of v of the successor. I should keep this s, it's the same, plus vi and v of I plus 1. That's all you do. Okay, that's the function. That's the implementation. Here's code. And this guy here actually will take order of 2 to the n. Because you do not cache here, right? You compute recursively the same subproblems time and again. And that would be the same as brute force, what you have been thinking. Because for every element, you decide in or out, in or out, in or out. You keep recursively going over all that stuff. That would take, in the worst case, let me put this as a lower bound, that's what matters here, omega of 2 to the n. So that would be the plain direct implementation of that recurrence. But that doesn't make sense, right? So we introduce here, and that's the second step of my Fibonacci playbook, okay? Memoization. You don't compute the same subproblem twice. So if you compute V4, for example, once, you store the one. That's very simple. It's just, we do the function. Let's call this V star, so the improved version. So then you look at the volume and are using an array V. So if the volume stored in the array V is undefined, I'm using this bottom symbol here for that, then you compute it. Okay, then you just set it. I have to do the if. Okay, then let me do it like this. It doesn't matter. If I is more than n, then you set vi to 0, and else you set vi to the maximum of, and now come here the recursive calls. So you will call the function v star with the successor of I recursively, sum the volume, and you will call the function with the I plus 1, and you set this volume. And here in the end, it's cached, and then you just return the cache. So you return vi, okay? And the recursive calls over here for vstar here and there, they will handle the smaller subproblems and they will store their solutions in their cache to avoid computing them. Okay. And now this guy has, so going back to there, we had something that's time theta of n. Actually, space is better here because you need only order of the number of recursive calls. It's order of n space only. The depth of the search tree. Yes. By the way, a quick question. Do you see the video or only the slides? So if I'm showing you something here on the video, do you see that? The slides are okay. That's important thing, I guess. I wasn't sure about it. Okay, good. So just to if it makes sense to show you something in the video. So the space is order of n because the recursive call tree here has depth at most n. If you go over that, you get your dynamic our dynamic programming. So your dynamic programming time and complexity. So now time and space will be order of n. The space comes from storing the array v, and the time comes from computing the elements in that array times order of one for computing each element. Okay. So now it goes drastically down. Okay. Does it make sense? Maybe looking over that. Okay. Makes sense. I see a yes. Max operations cached is order of one. Yes. I mean, what you have here is this, right? You have a max, you have a plus, that's it. And a plus one if you want, right? And a lookup of the success if you want. All that stuff is then order of one. And these recursive calls, I don't count them here. I count them in the recursive calls, but they will store the result. So they compute it once also, but then get it back. So I account the operations at the point where the value is stored once. And obviously for the lookup later and stuff like that, you have order one, two, or for this if you have order one, two, that is one, two. So every recursive call to V star I has a cost of order of one only. And each one will operate only once in storage. That's why you have an order of one only. It's the number of elements in the V table times the cost for computing it. Okay. That's always the way you can analyze dynamic programming algorithms we have seen in the first lecture. So it's much easier because you have just a table size times complexity for computing table entry. Okay. Let me have a look at the sequential implementation. So how would you do that? Well, you can just look at the next step in our Fibonacci playbook, right? You look at the array V, which are computing the elements 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and so on and so forth. What happens if I take a generic element I? The element I, you look at this part here again, it depends on the element at position SI and the element at position I plus 1. So the dependencies are like this. That would be I plus one. And at some point, I don't know, as of one. So dependencies go to the right only. Okay. Young is asking, how are we getting the successes? Is the graph of overlapping intervals? No, it's easier. I will So take an example again. Okay, let me put this down. Take a couple of examples. One, two, sorted by starting time already. Three, four, five, six, I don't know, seven, okay. Well, what is the success of one? Maybe that's your question or your answer. It's a graph of overlapping intervals, if you want. Yes. I mean, one has a overlap with two and three. So the first one I could take when I take one is four or five or six and so on. Okay. And if you look at two, one is already not considered. Two has an overlap with one and three. So the successor of two would be four. Two, the successor of three would be, since it has an overlap with four, but supposedly not with five, it would be five. The successor of four would be six. The successor of five would be seven. The successor of six would be eight. Interval eight does not exist, right? I have explained this in the video. I use this value. So if I have n intervals, I use the value n plus one as a dummy element. So if there's no successor, the subproblem will stop. Okay. That's how I compute. It's a simple loop over the intervals at the beginning. You can do it in order of n. Looking back here, we have this for a generic cell over here. So I, it depends on the cell or the table entry at I plus one to the right, and some guy here much more to the right, which depends on the problem. I don't know, it could be five elements, 20 elements, I don't know. It just goes forward somehow. If you see that, it gets clear, I hope, that you can just fill this table up from the last element, maybe if you want n plus one, that was our base case, to the left, okay? So a sequential algorithm would be v n plus one equals zero, and then for I equals n minus one down to one, just set vi to the max of v of the successor of I plus vi and v of I plus one. And now I don't have to do caching or checking or anything because I computed from the right to the left. These values here have been computed already. So I don't have to check that, they are there. Not just compute the next one. Okay. So this again is not better. Time and space still is linear. You can see that it's a simple loop and it still has the whole array. And that's more or less the best we can do in this case. Because I don't know how much the successor goes to the right. So I cannot throw away parts of this array while I'm computing it. So there's no direct space saving possible here. It's just time and space out of n, but we have now a sequential implementation. Finally, space saving wouldn't be easy, at least in this case, but recovering the solution, that's something we didn't look at yet. So how do I find out the solution? I will have the value of v1 at the end. That's the volume. And now you have to trace back, if you look at your V array again, okay, 1, 2, 3 up to N, and maybe the sentinel element N plus one over here. You look at the volume V1, that's the volume of the optimal solution. But what is the optimal solution? So which of the intervals do you want to have? Or which of the intervals do you have in the optimal solution? Okay. And then you have to trace back this. Yeah, we see over here again, an element depends on two subcases, I plus one and S of I. And one of these two guys is the maximum. And you take these guys. So the first element would depend on this one and the successor here. And one of them is max. So you forget the other. You go from here to there. Let's say this is a five. Okay. And that means element one is in. And now you look at V5. This is V5 over here. And V5 again depends on V6 and V of the successor of 5, which could be 12. And one of these two guys is max. Maybe it's this one this time. So you know here, you can forget about the other part. And you know here, element five is out. 2, 3, and 4 are out anyway, because they overlap with one. That's the reason you went to the successor, right, of one, which is 5. And then you get to 6. You're looking at V6, and the game repeats, right? 6 depends on 7 and the successor of 6, which may be, I don't know, successor of 6, which may be 17. And you look, and one of these two guys is the max. If it's this one, that would mean 6 is in the solution. And you can forget about the other part, and so on. That's what's meant by tracing back the solution. So you make a compute like this over here, maybe sequentially, a bit more efficient, the whole array of V values. And at the end, you get the value of your solution, in this case, V1, in the cell, in some designated cell. You know the optimal solution, the value of the optimal solution. But to get the optimal solution itself, you go then back to your table, your array in this case, and trace back the decisions. So which decision led to the optimal value? There was a maximum over 2, and one of them is maximum. If both have the same volume, you can choose either one. But then you trace back, oh, the maximum comes from there, comes from there, comes from there, comes from there, and so on, until hitting the base case again. And then you have the solution. One is in, 5 is not in, 6 is in, and so on and so forth. Okay. Maybe let me clear that here. Does that make sense? It's okay. I will take in a bit more time for the weighted interval scheduling here. Maybe we'll have a look at the other others too, but I mean, the main ideas are all here. So it's important to understand how to trace that out. So circus is the next no overlap. Yes, exactly. It's the next interval that does not overlap with the interval I, which is the argument here. So the success of 5 would be 12. That means 5 has an overlap with 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and 11. So if you take 5, you can take 6 to 11, and you go directly to 5. That's it. That's the success. Okay. I explained in the video also, I make that from forward to the back. If you look at the book of Klein and Tabisch, then make it in the other direction. That's also possible. It's not a problem. So we have a kind of a forward dynamic programming here. And you could also do a backward dynamic programming. And then you have the predecessor, which is not the one. That works in the same way. Okay. Yeah. So all good with that example. Here we have the whole, what I call the Fibonacci playbook. Again, right? The idea, subproblems, decisions, how to represent them, a recurrence, which defines it, then immediately a recursive implementation, immediately a dynamic, more efficient implementation by memorization, by analyzing the dependency patterns, you get a sequential implementation. And then by tracing back the volumes, the decisions through that table, you can recover the optimal solution. Seems to be okay. Okay, so let me quickly do the following over here. I want to quickly head over to my desktop and show you the code, which is very simple. Just to just like this kind of show me the evidence, right? So here's the evidence. Because I wanted to point out how simple the stuff is when you go to implementing that. So what I'm doing here is the following. Let's start at the top. Okay, let's do it like this. Okay, so all output clear. So I'm choosing here 30 intervals. I generate 30 random starting times from 1 to 30. I'm choosing 30 random execution times from 1 to 6, just to compute the finishing times, which are the starting times over here, plus the processing times. And I'm computing also 30 random weights between 1 and 10. Okay, so that will be the first part. It's just generating a random problem. Okay. Now I'm going to sort in the next step. Remember that for applying this dynamic programming solution, I have to sort by, in the case I'm using, by sort by starting times over here. So I get the permutation, actually, sigma, which orders the starting times by in a non-decreasing manner, and then I'm sorting starting times, finishing times, and weights in the same way. Okay, that's that. And here is actually a couple of questions. How are we getting? Iago has been asking how we're getting successes, and is it the next node overlap? Yes. And here I'm computing the successes, okay? And it's very simple. So the successes are all n plus one. And then I go over all the intervals, 1 to n, and I take j being the next interval, I plus one. And then while the start of j is before the end, before the finishing of I keep increasing j. In this way, it's actually a little bit stupid because that loop maybe takes order of n squared time in the worst case or something like that. So that would be cost more, right, computing successes in that manner than the whole algorithm later because it's only linear time. But I wanted to make it quick. Actually, you don't need to start with the index j at I plus 1 every time. So you can do this in linear. But down here, then I show you in the first line the successes, in the second line the start dates, in the third line the finishing dates, and then the fifth line the volumes, which do not matter. So you can see the first interval is from 1 to 4, and the second is from 1 to 3, and the other is from 2 to 4, the next is from 2 to 5, and so on. The successor of the first interval is 5 because it has an overlap with 1, 3, it has an overlap with 2, 4, it has an overlap with 2, 5, this is the fourth, but it does not overlap with 4, 6. So 1, 4 is immediately followed by 4, 6. So the success of 1 is 5. The success of 2 is 5, 2, because 1, 3 has an overlap with 2, 4 and with 2, 5, but 4, 6 does not overlap with 1, 3, and so on. Okay, so you can see the successes over here. That makes sense. And then we just can do what we did in the simple implementation of memorization, I use a dictionary here, not even an array, from the integers to the integers. So V is just, so V of I would be the volume. Volume of the optimal solution for intervals I plus 1 da, up to n. Okay. That's what it is. And then I just look here. You see the direct implementation of this memorization. If the direction does not have the key, does not have the key, so weighted intervals can be on WIS of I looks up the key. If it's not there, I compute it. If I is more than n, it's 0. Otherwise, it's a max of recursive call to WIS with the success of I plus the volume VI or the larger of a recursive call to I plus 1. I store it here and then I return it. That's it. That's the function. It's straightforward. And then I create an empty dictionary here. So at the beginning, there are no keys. That's the undefined volume. And I'm calling the thing. And it comes out the optimal solution volume is 75. Okay. So I have these 30 intervals, starting times, finishing times. There are the weights, random volumes from 1 to 10. And I can get up to 75 here. That would be the best possible. Okay. And now we want to extract the solution by tracing back. So that code is actually a little bit harder than to compute the volume. So what I'm going to do with this WIS sol is return the solution. So it's I is more than n, so there are no intervals. I return an empty list, an empty array. Otherwise, I'm checking the cases just as we did in the slides. There are two cases. Either the element is in, then I have the subproblem taking the successor plus V of I, or the element is out, then I have the subproblem I plus 1. And I look which one is larger, because I have the maximum. So if the first one is larger, element I is in, then I compute the solution for the successor problem, all the intervals which are in the successor problem, and then I prepend I because I was in and I return this. And otherwise I just compute the solution for I plus 1 to the end and get the other list. And one of these two lists will come out here. That's all. That means that's the implementation of tracing back the decisions. Just looking, okay, what was the decision really that gave me VI and then doing it. Okay, so if you do that, let's run that. Comes out the solution. So the solution is take the intervals at index 4, 6, 10, 11, 14, 17, 20. And if you print it, you see something like that. Okay. It should be non-overlapping and it should be optimal. 2 to 5, then 5 to 8, and 8 to 9, 10 to 11, 12 to 14, 14 to 17, 20 to 21, 26 to 24, and so on and so forth. The other values and all that stuff sums up to 75. That's the optimal one. Okay. So that's code. Does that make sense? Is that okay? Any questions on that? Does it okay? Yeah, me, are you? It's okay. It's clear? Good. Yeah. So I will publish that at the workbook also. You can play with that code. It should be That should be how you do it. It's very simple. If you have the recursive differential charge, I keep iterating over that because it's so surprisingly simple. Dynamic programming is so useful. If you want to learn only one technique, it should be dynamic programming. And it's very simple to implement, at least a basic version of that. So we just take a dictionary, a hash table, and store the volumes. You come up, if you solve the problem coming up with a recursive definition, you just take a hash table, put the values in, and you implement it directly recursively, just with the OT. And that's it. Or you could take the sequential version too. Okay. So that's the code. I think that's what I wanted to say about the weighted interval scheduling. So if you have any question on that, maybe we could moment ask about that. Otherwise, let me move on to clear this over here. So let me move on to the matrix multiplication. So our second problem, and I'll try to make that fast enough. Hopefully that problem is clear. I mean, it's also in the video, the first part, and see if you see that the problem structure, how it plays out, and maybe you can focus on some parts of the complexity and the sequential implementation and recovering the volume. If that's not clear, because I've been skipping that in the videos, I'm just saying, okay, apply the Fibonacci playbook. So you want to multiply a couple of matrices. And these guys are compatible, so you can multiply them in that order, which means, okay, M1 has some size and M2 has some size, and I call these size actually B0 and B1, and then 2 has a size B1 times B2, and so you can multiply them and you get a matrix B0, B2. Okay. But you can also multiply M2 and M3. So M3 has a size, so M2 has B1, B2, and M3 has a size B2, B3. So if you multiply these guys, you get a B1, B3 matrix, and so on. So we have a sequence of matrices, like let me put one down here, so this one. And the main problem is in which order I'm going to multiply that, right? You could just multiply these two guys first, and then these two. And then with M1, or you do it differently. You multiply these two, and then multiply them together, for example. And that makes a difference in the complexity of the operations, as you have seen in the video. So for different parameterizations, you get a different number of total operations. That's the whole point here. So the question is, what I put here, we want the multiplication order that minimizes the total number of operations. Let's stop for a second. Is that clear? Okay, any questions on the problem itself? Could you transpose any matrix before formulation? No. No. The answer is no, because if you multiply, I want the product. I want the product of these matrices. Okay, that is some result M, and actually, this M is M1 times M2 times M3 times M4. Which is the same as M1 times M2 times M3 times M4, okay? It always comes out the same matrix, and I want this matrix here. It's just a question, how do I do it? Like this or like that? What's cheaper? Okay. Now if you transpose this matrix here, there comes out a different matrix over there. I don't want it. You could transpose it only if it's symmetric, maybe, but that's then pointless, right? Because a symmetric matrix is transposed the same. You can also not transpose it for a different reason. Compatible means, right? So again, M1, so the number of lines, the number of lines is B0, the number of columns is B1. So to multiply to M2, right, the number of lines must be B1, and the number of columns is B2, for example. Excuse me. That's what compatible means. So you can multiply these two matrices. Now if you transpose this guy here, you cannot multiply them anymore. So the matrices are not square. Not necessary. Okay, nice. Yeah, I guess that's answering your question. So Mateus, I see a no. Any question on the problem? No, no question. Okay. But is it clear or not? Or want to hopefully, yep, okay. Yeah, thanks. Okay. That's the first no I was then. Okay. So yeah. Never mind, it's okay. You see, it should be clear. So that's what we do. I have been commenting. Here I have it. I have a slide for that. Okay, these are for four matrices. These are all the parameterizations you can have. And everyone is different. I have shown this in the video. I have the numbers here. Right, take some sizes. For example, these guys 3, 1, 1, 4, 4, 1, 1, 5, and just make just compute it. So you see that you get different numbers of multiplications and additions. And the best one would be the second in this case, or the fourth with only 24 multiplications. So the best one would be a pattern like this, and I've got a pattern like that. So it seems to be good to multiply M1 and M3 first, and then you can multiply M4 and M1, or M1 and M4 in any order. Doesn't make a difference. So that's what we want to find out. And the brute force solution, so the total number of proper parameterizations is in order of, I should probably put an omega here. Because I want a lower bound here, but it's actually, well, you have the concrete number over here, and that is exponential. The number of possible solutions here is exponential in n. It's an exponential number of valid parameterizations, so you can test them all and compute the cost before you compute the multiplication rate. The main insight here then is the following. What we really need to know is, where does this thing break up? Let me put this again here. I mean, there is a top level break where you compute the first and the second part, and then you multiply it. That's over here. That's over there. Or here, or there, or there. So there can be, at any point between the matrices, could be the top level break, and then you have two subproblems. Make this one cheapest and this one cheapest, or this one, this one, or this one, this one, and this one, and this one, and this one, and this one. Yeah. So you condition just on the top level break. So if I knew the top level break, I could recursively compute the optimal way of computing the rest. And then I check all the cases. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, this case. And I just look, what is the best, the overall minimal solution. So that's the main insight. And here it's interesting maybe to go a bit slower again, because that's the way you solve the problem. We are a step before the dynamic programming solution, because the insight here is, I have a chain, a list of matrices. I don't know how to multiply them, but I have to break it up at some point. And that gives a smaller list of matrices on the right side and a smaller list of matrices on the left side, which I need to compute optimally. And then I have to, then I can check over all these cases. So the subproblems will be to find the optimal multiplication for intervals of matrices from I to J in the general case. Does it make sense, the basic idea of that? That should be so. Other seems to be okay. Any question on this? seems to be not the case at the moment. So, well, I said we are a small step before the dynamic programming solution. So, well, here it is. Since I'm talking about intervals from I to J, actually I will be talking about intervals from I to K, just have the indices. So I'm calling then, after recognizing that this is the subproblem, I will giving it a name. So MIK is the least number of multiplications I need for computing the product of matrices I to K. And then I have here the implementation of my idea. So the base case is very simple. Let's look at this first quickly. I equals K, it's only a single matrix. There's nothing to do, just return it. There are no multiplications here. Otherwise, so I is strictly less than K. There are two or more matrices in this chain. So you want to multiply MI, MI plus one, da, 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 up to MK. And what you do is you choose a breakpoint J, which is after I or after I plus one or after K minus one here or here or here, but not over here, neither over there. Okay. So the J, the breakpoint, if you want, the top level multiplication ranges from I to K. And then you look, okay, what does it cost if you break after after J? You have to multiply the matrices from I to J, and you have to multiply the matrices from J plus one to K. So you look what that costs, and you add the cost then for multiplying the resulting matrices. That would be BI minus one, BJ, and BK. So you can see from the dimensions of the matrices. And that's it. You minimize over all the possible breakpoints here because you don't know which one is the right one. Okay, you make the minimization. And for avoiding computing that time and again, you store the values of the intermediate solutions that you compute the MIKs in a table. And here again, we are at the main idea. That's it. If this is clear, and you can write down this recurrence, as I said before, the creative part is over. Now you have immediately an implementation, a recursive implementation with memoization, which gives you the right time and space complexity, and you can check the dependency pattern, and you can write a sequential algorithm, and you can recover the solution if you want. Okay. Does that make sense? Maybe. Let me clear that up. Okay, any questions to that? On that? No questions at the moment. I know from experience that many don't get dynamic programming at the first part, the first time. I don't know why, but it's not completely obvious. Maybe I know why. Maybe, but I'm doing this for too long time, so it's not completely clear. So if you want to, at the moment there's no question. Maybe there come up questions later on. If it's clear, I'm happy. So that's the goal. Maybe they come up questions later, we'll see. But here again is the main part. I could ask, so just to see if that's clear, what's the time and space complexity? Maybe you remember it from the video. So how many subproblems do we have at most? The basic concepts are clear, but the exercises are hard to solve. Okay. Yes and no. Let me make a comment on that. I don't want to be snappy. I could say if the exercises are hard to solve, the basic concepts are not clear. That's not true. But it's just like you. Just to make the comparison, I gave the comparison. We are talking here, I don't know, tactics of modern football, okay? We're talking about, I don't know, a 4-3-4 system and how you place and how you put the ball and if you do tiki-taka or not and so on. That's what we're talking. You say, oh, wow, that's clear. Okay, yeah, I know that. We played 4-3-4 or whatever, and we do it like this and we do it like that. Now you go out in the field and you want to make goals. And then it's less clear. So it's the ideas are here on the table and we're discussing them, but it's hard to implement that strategy, and it needs training and it's exercises. So that's the difference between. So don't if you take the main ideas here from the lectures, and I can clear up any questions. And you can ask questions about climatology or whatever, and then we are good. But then you have to apply it to exercise. You should do the exercise. I said it at the beginning. I should say it again. Do all the exercise in climatology, as much of the exercise as you can. Not only the list. You should read climatology and do the exercise, at least a good part of them. That will give you the real ability. Of applying that stuff in practice, and the exercise is also the exercises force you to do that. Really. So after discussing tactics at the table, now we go out in the field and see that. Okay. So to play the ball a little bit, let me ask you. So what is the time and space complexity here? What's the space for storing all the subproblem volumes here? That should be easy to see. Order of n, time order of n, space order of n squared. Okay, space order of n squared, time order of n. Yeah. Okay, I see. Oh, good. Yeah, it seems that seems okay. Or other stuff. Yeah, it's a space order of squared. Time is order of n cubed. Yeah. Well, I have interpreted this in a different manner, which could be right too. So yeah, look at this table. That's a matrix or table with two indices, whatever you want to call it. First index ranges from 1 to n, and the second index ranges from 1 to n. So this is obviously theta of n squared space. We store all that stuff. Now, for computing a single volume, take another color over here, right? For computing a single volume, you have to minimize over all that stuff here. And that could be take up to order of n. You do that. So order of n time per volume. So that gives you overall the order of n squared volumes times order of n for computing depth. So it's a linear time, order of n for computing each volume, overall cubic time. And that's it, yes. So analysis, again, is very simple. You don't have to do the recursive stuff, actually. It's so there are no recurrences to solve, just like in divide and conquer. Usually it's the number of, since you're caching, there are no, you attribute this to the cache. So size of the cache, size of the table, times complexity per entry gives overall time complexity, and the size of the table is the space complexity. So, okay. Now I think I make a copy of that. Okay. Fibonacci playbook again. Okay. You should be able to see that you have an immediate recursive implementation, which is very bad. You have the implementation of the memorization immediately, which has this time and space complexity. So this time and space complexity over here. That would be memorization. You can find, you can find a sequential implementation of that stuff by looking at the dependencies. And you can recover the solution and not only the volume of the optimal solutions. And you could think about space saving too. I don't remember if I thought about space saving in this case. but the standard argument probably applies here that you can save space if you only want the number of operations, the volume, but if you want to recover the solution, you have to pay for the whole memory. In the next lecture on Thursday, we will see how to avoid that. I would like to skip that part, except if you have questions directly. Otherwise, you could do it as an exercise. I mean, you can find my GSM education internet too. That would be pointless if you really want to find it. But since the matrix multiplication is not in the book, you could try to discover the dependencies while filling the MIK matrix over here. And based on that, write down a sequential algorithm for filling this matrix. And not the recursive one, but memorization. And you could also, based on that, and think about how to recover the solution at the end. That should be doable or clear, hopefully. Okay. I don't know if there's any. So let this. If there's not an immediate question to that, but it would be the same steps, the same sequence of steps, same thinking, but well, the case, the particular case is different. Okay. So I think there's not an immediate question. Then I will go to the next problem, okay, that we can see, which is the traveling salesperson. So the most famous problem, one of the most famous combinatorial optimization problems we have in computer science. And I guess you know that problem well. You have n cities, we have non-negative distances between the cities, so every pair of cities has a distance, something like that. Or if you have one more, it's everybody with everybody, something like that. You have all these distances. So here's a city I, there's a city j, that's a distance dij. They are all non-negative, and you want a tour, so a sequence of cities which visits every city exactly once and then goes back to the origin. That's a tour. There are many tours, and you want the one with a total distance minimum, so the shortest tour. How many tours are there? Maybe you remember from the video. So asking about the brute force approach. You could think, oh yeah, let's list all tours and look just which one is the smallest. N factorial, that's it. It's a permutation. The number of permutations is n factorial. You can reduce this a little bit, but it doesn't matter. And n factorial is more than exponential. I'm saying that it goes like n to the n, roughly. It's n to the n over n plus something. So that's it grows very fast. You have many, many permutations. You cannot list them all. So if you would do this like brute force, it's you get stuck at 14 cities or 13 or 15 or something like that. Very, very small number of cities can do this explicitly. That's common over here, right? Enumerating all permutations will take all of n to the n, so that won't do. On the other hand, you may think, okay, that's cool because the problem is NP-hard anyway. We know that. So we don't expect polynomial time. There won't be I mean, there could be a polynomial time algorithm, but that would be a major breakthrough in computer science. You don't expect this to get this by simple dynamic programming, probably. But we want to get that cost down a little bit. For the solution, for the basic insight for the solution, then is, well, and that's not so deep, actually. In this case, I have to decide, well, I'm standing at a certain city. Maybe I start at city one, and then I have to decide what will be the next one of all the unvisited cities. Maybe this is three. And now I have to decide what is the next one. Maybe this is seven. And now I have to decide what is the next one, and so on. The guys which I have been visiting, so one and three, obviously are not options anymore. And at the end of the day, when I have been visiting the last city, I just go back to one. Okay. So a sub-problem I have to solve when I think about this in this way is, I am given a current city, that's where I stand. I have a subset of still unvisited cities, which I have to visit, and I have to choose one. Yeah. Right, so the goal is to choose one over this. And if this is empty, then I go return. I will return to city one. So I'm starting at city one. This is without loss of generality. We can assume that we are starting at city one because it doesn't matter where we start in the tool. We can normalize that to city one. Maybe stop here for a question. Does it make sense? Again, as in the previous problem, we are now at a point that that's the main insight. It seems probably, is there any question? Does it make sense? Is it clear? Quick feedback, okay. Okay, no questions at the moment. Yeah. It's maybe from some point of view that doesn't seem too deep. I'm at a current city, I have a set of unvisited cities, I have to go on to that. But actually, that's very close to the dynamic programming formulation we're going to see next. So that's actually it's not so easy maybe to come up with that if you see that problem at the first time. But once thinking about it like this, I think it's rather clear. But this gives you immediately a dynamic programming formulation if you think about it. So we have been saying a subproblem consists of a current city. That's this guy here, current city, and a set of unvisited cities, and that's this here, this set here. So, and TIV will be the shortest tour that starts at the current city I and needs to visit all the cities in V and then returns to one. That's all we're gonna do. In dynamic programming problems, the order of sorting is not important. I'm not 100% sure, Fazia, what you were. We should sort. It depends, maybe, if I get your question right. Think about the weighted interval scheduling. Increasing or decreasing is not important. Yes. If Okay. An answer in three steps, maybe. If you think about weighted interval scheduling, what we've seen before, there it is important to sort by starting dates or by finishing dates or times, starting times and finishing times. Otherwise, the number of subproblems could be too large. What you want to sort such that you have prefixes or suffixes of the set. And that gives you a linear number of subproblems. For this problem, it is not important if you sort in increasing or decreasing order. This holds also for similar problems on sequencing. The question would be, it depends a little bit on the type of the problem. If you think about subset sum or Knapsack, there the order of the items does not matter at all. It can be a random order. You don't need to sort because the order of the items does not matter. I mean, the sequencing problems, the scheduling problems have an order. It's the interval order. And if you choose one, that includes excludes several other intervals. If you don't do that, you don't get a linear number of subproblems. For the Knapsack and the subset sum, you always have a linear number of subproblems. You just take the prefix or the suffix. So in the Knapsack and subset sum, it doesn't matter if you go from the first to the last or from the last to the first, but the order is when you can make a random shuffle at the beginning and the algorithm works exactly the same. And here for the traveling salesperson, there's also no order. You have just this current city, right? And a set of unvisited cities. And well, it's a set. How you store that is a different problem, but the order of storage really doesn't matter. So there's no sorting order here. So it depends on the problem type. You have some kind of implicit order, then sorting may matter. And then in general, it's very difficult to make general affirmations on that. But I would say in general, one of the most problems that I remember now, if you need a sorting order, it doesn't matter if you go increasing or decreasing. Depends on how, if you do a forward or backward dynamic programming. Okay. Let's go to our traveling salesperson. So the subproblem is current city and unvisited cities. What we really want to compute is if you start at city one, you visit all the other stuff, all the vertices. So this would be the vertices or the cities would be all the guys from one to n without one. So that's actually the set from two to n. Okay. Being at one, which is then visited already, visit all the rest from two to n and go back to one. That's what we want to compute. This is the volume we want to compute. T1 set two to the n. Okay. And we do it like we said we're gonna do. First of all, base case, simple. If there's no city to visit anymore, the set is empty, just go back from the current city I to one, and it costs di1. Otherwise, there are still cities to visit. Choose one. We said here, choose one of these. Actually, I don't know which one is the right one, so I test all of them. So you go over all the cities in the set of unvisited cities. You go from here, I, to that city that costs div. And then you are at the current city V now, new city. And you have to visit all these guys except V. Now V has been visited. So you recursively compute the value for TV V minus V, there are lots of Vs here, at the distance for going from D to IV. And that would be the cost when the next city is Oui. And since you don't know what the right next city is, make the minimum over all of them. And here you have the recursive implementation, or the recursive idea, so the idea of breaking the traveling salesperson problem into sub-problems by choosing the next unvisited city and going there and making systematically all the choices possible. That's written down here. So this is the recurrence you can use to solve the traveling salesperson problem by dynamic programming. Okay. So we have again this two-step approach, the idea and the recursive definition. And now I think I have here a I have the playbook, where is it, over here again. So I could think about these sequence of steps. I keep repeating this because you should get used to that, thinking about that. You have an immediate recursive implementation, okay, which would be very bad, but you want to do it with memorization, so store the subproblems, and then it's okay. We will see time and space complexity in a second. You could think about the dependency patterns in the table and make a sequential implementation. And based on that, it should be simple to recover the solution. And you may think about space saving again, but this will be the main topic for the next lecture. So all this Fibonacci playbook again can be played out here. You make a whole sequence of steps, and you get an efficient sequential implementation, you get the complete solution, and not only the volume. Right? So the T, this guy here, so T1, 2 to N is the volume of the solution. And you want to recover the solution by tracing it back. Okay. Each visit step needs to have the minimal distance. No, or I maybe don't get the question completely. Could be random. Not sure how to answer that, Marcio. If you look at this, I'm so the argument here is I'm standing at city I, and all these guys must be visited. So I check them all systematically, everyone. So it's not random in that sense. I don't take just a random successor here. I take them all. And the choice depends on the distance, yes, because the distance is here. If I go to the next city V, it costs DIV. So let me clean up a little bit. So it's getting too cluttered over here already, okay? If I'm standing at city I, and the next guy I want to go there is V, it costs DIV. There's no minimal distance between I and V. It's just the distance for going from I. So I'm standing here, and they say you go to V, and it costs DIV. That's where the distance. And the choice, so the minimum here, depends on the distances. Yes, because you have the cost for going there, plus the cost for the rest of the tour. That must be computed. And then you sum these two guys over here, and you take the minimum over all possible continuations. It's not random here. You test them all. Test all. And then you take the best one. So the minimum tour starting from I over here is obtained by minimizing over all the possible continuations from I. That must be the best one. The algorithm is completely deterministic. And the minimization is here. So the minimum distance, to some sense, is over here. Here's the minimum. Does it make sense? Hopefully. Do you want to make a follow-up question, maybe? Or does it make sense? Okay, the moment seems clear. Maybe, okay. Yeah. So let's look at time and space complexity. If this part is clear. So what would be the space complexity? 2 to the n times n comes immediately. Time 2 to the n times n squared. Yes. Okay. Does that make sense to all of you? Because that's the answer, indeed. Everybody, maybe yes or no or something or a comment. Space complexity 2 to the n times n. Time complexity 2 to the n times n squared. We're training our eyes to see that completely, immediately, without computing anything. Does it make sense? You're looking at these two arguments. What's the size of the table? Just to see that. I ranges from 1 to 2 over n. We are subsets. Yeah, up to 2 to the n subsets over here. That gives you space for storing all the table of, if you store it all down, theta 2 to the n. That's what we have over here. Now it's our subsets. That's different. And we cannot avoid this in the traveling salesman, okay? At least not in this simple way. Yeah. And it makes sense because we have said the problem is MP complete or MP hard, or if you want. So it's it could not be so good. Okay. So we have space out of 2 to 10 n. And the minimization over here has time out of n. We have up to n vertices in that set. Size of V could be up to n, less than equal n. But we don't know how many there are. At the beginning there are more, at the end there are less. So you have 2 to the n times n cells. And now the time complexity would be filling all these 2 to the n cells, and each one costs order of n. So you end up with a time complexity of order 2 to the n n squared. Okay. That's what you can see from this immediately. Okay, with that, any question on that? At the moment, seems to be okay. Don't see any additional question over here. So yeah, that's no question now. Maybe have a look at this, and at the beginning of the next session on Thursday, we can have a look at this again. I try to, they always follow the same pattern. Size of the table times complexity of filling in a single entry. That's always, you can always look at the arguments of the table if you want. Number of, I call it a table, call it a hash table or something like that. It could be like the table here, the TIV is more complicated, right? It's not a simple matrix. It has n lines for each city, and it has 2 to the n columns. It's a huge, it's a matrix, right? But for every possible subset, it has a column. So that's most conveniently implemented as a hash table. Yeah, so follow the same pattern for dynamic programming. Yeah, for dynamic programming. So because dynamic programming is storing subproblems in a table. So I have the table size times the complexity of filling each entry, and that gives you the whole complexity. So table size, so space complexity, and table size times complexity of filling in the entry is the time complexity. That's always the case. Does it make sense? More questions? That? Okay. Good. So, well, now you can get the XKCD joke here after that lecture. A bit better, at least, right? Okay. Turing salesman, brute force solution, n factorial, dynamic programming algorithms, n squared two to the n, selling on eBay, order of one. Okay. So what we've been seeing is exactly this one. Yeah? That's by the way, I should mention the name here. This is due to Bellman, right? So it's a Bellman. Bellman came up with this in the 50s, I guess, or in the 60s, I'm not sure. End of the 50s, start of the 60s, maybe. With that dynamic programming solution to the driving salesman, and then you get n squared. Much better than brute force. Still much worse than state of the art. You won't get too far with that. Basically, because the space is too much. You have 2 to the n space, and if you want to put lots of cities here, 1,000 cities would be 2 to the 1,000. It's impossible. 2 to the 100 is impossible, actually. So you can't store the whole thing. You can save a little bit, you can shave a little bit off, but essentially this is limited by memory. So state of the art would be very, very, very different, actually. So, yeah. But it's an interesting pattern which comes up in different other parts of dynamic programming. Okay. Let me stop sharing over here. I guess that's it for the moment. There are no questions anymore. Okay, just to wrap up. So we have a due date for the second list today. So just turn in the second list. Someday later, maybe tomorrow, I will put up the two questions for Divide and Conquer part. And we meet again on can be sent after midnight. Yes. So between midnight and maybe 6 in the morning, I won't start reading your solutions. Okay. Let me tell you a secret. Okay, just another one. If you send it even later, I will still accept it. But if I say that right now, maybe everybody sends it only on Friday. I want to avoid that because maybe will be on the end of the semester. So I maybe have to give a discount or something like that. Okay. It's more important to me that you can finish the questions and get to a solution and you get points for that than the due date. The due dates are only for avoiding that I have to get that I get everything at the end of the semester, like times 18 times 4 lists, and I have to sit down for a whole week to doing it. It's not just like spacing it out. So at some point I have to increase the pressure a little bit to get the questions back. But if for some reason someone is late or has some problems, I will accept it later. If you don't push me against the wall of the end of the semester, so if you don't maybe send it then in August or something like that. Last question about the list, of course, why could you use the maximum expected reward to solve the problem? The question is about the maximizing the expected reward. You have a it's probabilistic, but the expected value is not. I mean, if you throw a dice, it's probabilistic, it comes out 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, you don't know. But the expected value is 3.5. That's it. Now, if I would allow you to, I mean, if you have a dice, all the 6 sides have 1/6 of the probability. And I tell you, yeah, well, you can shift the probabilities a little bit between, say, 1/12 and the double. So how do you shift the probabilities to maximize the expected volume? Then you would probably put the most probability on six, on the six side, and the second most on the five side, and so on and so forth. And that maximizes it. The process still is probabilistic, but the expected value is not. The expected value is the sum over all possible cases of the probability of that case happening times the value in that case. That's a fixed number. But now you have in the question one, on this show question, you have different orders, right, for the questions. And every order has an expected volume. It's just a number. And over all the possible orders, you want the maximum expected volume. That's what happens. Okay. Using this to select the sorting order and afterwards expiring exchange element to the proof. Yes, that would be the idea. So you assume some order, maybe, okay, 1 to n, whatever, and you look at two subsequent questions, and now you change the order of these two guys. And that changes the expected volume from one volume to the other. And then you look if it goes up and it goes down, and what are the conditions for going up or going down? And then you conclude something from that. And that's the exchange argument. Then you're done. If you see that, you can extract a pattern, a conclusion from that, you will see a order emerge from that. And then you say, okay, let's just sort in that order, and that's it. Okay. That's the idea of an exchange argument. Both of the questions can be done with exchange arguments in this case. Okay. Isn't it possible to choose, just use induction? I'm not sure. Maybe. I'm not saying that exchange arguments are the only solutions. Maybe you could do it like, induction is we have seen it in the lectures, induction coupled to the greedy algorithm states I had. So it's ahead in the first, in the second, and the third, and by induction, it's all of them. So argument of that kind would work. So if it's correct, no problem. I'm not, okay, that's an important thing. Sometimes people have the impression, some of you have the impression that I want an exchange argument because I said it can be done with an exchange argument. That's not the case. Everything that's okay is okay. Means you can prove it however you want, if I can understand the math. So it could be greedy algorithm stays ahead, exchange argument, everything else. If you can transform it to something I still can understand and see your proof working, it's okay. You don't need to use exchange argument. Just need to explain how. Yes, give a proof. It must be correct. You cannot solve it by divination. I asked the Oracle at Delphi and it said me, it's like this. You have to show me how it's done. So it's maybe possible. I really can't, Eduardo, probably answer that complete because I don't know if the just is just. I mean, the induction can be simpler, it can be harder. Maybe it's not just. And tell a good story. Oh yeah, I like good stories, but there must be also a kind of a mathematical undercurrent in that good story, okay? Must be a true good story. And the truth must be you write the story and a mathematician believes it, or a computer scientist with thus optimization believes it, then it's a good story. Okay. Any question? A good end is a low complexity and correctness. Yeah, that's the thing. Okay. Any more comment on the questions maybe or something like that? Okay, no. Well, we're 10, 11 minutes over time in that asking my question. If there comes up anything, send me an email. I have been exchanging with a couple of you, so just anything, any question. But again, I try to give counter examples or stuff like that. If I can come up with something, Also, if, as always, if you have questions about the, on today's lecture, send me an email. You can discuss this all on Thursday. So, well, if there's nothing anymore, I'm